All right, so 7:10. I belong to my beloved, and his desire is for me. Come, my beloved, let us go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let us go early to the vineyards to see the vines have budded. If their blossoms have opened and if the pomegranates are in bloom, there I will give you my love. The mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both new and old, that I have stored up for you, my beloved. If only you were to me like a brother, who was nursed at my mother's breast, then if I found you outside, I would kiss you, and no one would despise me. I would lead you, and bring you to my mother's house, she who has taught me. I would give you spiced wine and drink, the nectar of my pomegranates. His left arm is under my head, and his right arm embraces me. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Under the apple tree I roused you. There your mother conceived you. There she who was in labour gave you birth. Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm, for love is as strong as death. Its jealousy unyielding is the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, like a mighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot sweep it away. If one were to give all the wealth of one's house for love, it would be utterly scorned.
And they lived happily ever after. That's the way our rom-coms go, don't they? That's the way our fables go. That's the way, you know, Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty. It's just they lived happily ever after. We've come some of that way in that story over the first 2 weeks in the Song of Songs. It is hard to see a narrative, but I think there is some progression from early chapters of interest and catching each other's attention, kind of courting each other. And then that was kind of the crazy love, not that that dissipates, last week, was the consummation, the wedding, and the sexual union and the joining of two lives together into one flesh. But it's not happily ever after. That's only half of the song. We've got the second half tonight, and I know that's a big tall order. It's actually hard to work out how it all fits together. But it's not a happily ever after story. The song is wisdom literature, and so it's far too realistic to kind of paint that sort of even an idealized marriage relationship in those kind of tones. There's far more complexity in life to deal with, even in a really, really good marriage. We all know, don't we, that a good marriage is not one without problems. A good marriage is one that has the strength of a myriad of problems that have all been faced and resolved as best as is possible in this life. Some problems can't be resolved in this life. But that's a good marriage, one that has the strength of a myriad of problems all faced and resolved as best as is possible in this life. And I just want to take you to some of the places. As I said, we've got half the book to deal with tonight, so feel cheated that we won't look at every verse. But I'll show you some of the places where I think this sense comes out, that it's not happily ever after. And one of them is just in that passage that Jono just read, as confusing as it is, 8 verse 1, where this is her voice, and she says, "If only you were like a brother who nursed at my brother's breasts, then if I found you outside, I would kiss you and no one would despise me." She wants to be affectionate, you see, with her groom, and it just doesn't always seem appropriate. She wants deep companionship and friendship, and she doesn't want the social conventions of the time about how married couples should behave to kind of mess with that relationship. That's weird, isn't it? Have you ever thought about that? I know that there are lots of kind of social pressures on single people, especially if you're Christian and you're still single at 30, because you get pressure from your Christian friends. You know, it's time to start a family. And you get pressure from your workmates. Come on, just shack up. And so you're kind of like, whoa. But married people get the pressure of social conventions as well. I mean, how familiar with each other can you be in public? There's kind of this almost fine line that you have to kind of work. If you go too far, then, you know, you kind of get frowned on. Like, oh, gee, just those lovebirds again. I go home, go to your room. But then if you're not familiar enough with each other in public, then there's kind of questions as well, isn't there? Like, is there any issues here, guys? Any problems? My wife works at a church, and so she often gets to church earlier before I, and so I rock up at church starting time, and often I can't kind of see where she is, and so, you know, just sit down. Is everything okay between you and Megan? You're not sitting together. So there are certain pressures on married couples, especially about how they relate in public. But then there's also probably a deeper problem, actually, which is that as you go along in your marriage, you're committed to each other, right? But who the other person is just kind of enlarges. You see new vistas of who they are and a new depths to their personality and things that just kind of mystify you. And I didn't realize this was so important to you. You see this, I think, in chapter 6. So flick back to chapter 6. If you have a Bible, maybe share it or just go and look it up later. But this is 6 verse 4. And it's his voice. He's saying, "You are as beautiful as Tirzah, my darling, as lovely as Jerusalem." Most of this kind of section of the song is familiar type of language. We've heard it before. In fact, some of the words are exactly the same as chapter 4. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep coming down from the washing, blah, blah, blah. But this is verse 5. You're as lovely as Jerusalem. And then there's this really interesting tone. As majestic as troops with banners. Turn your eyes from me. They overwhelm me. Verse 10, similar, of chapter 6. There's this sense of that she is terrible. Terribly important. Terribly profound. In ways that he had never comprehended before. And he's overwhelmed. Now, this again is one of those kind of things about marriage, is you kind of find out things about each other. As you go, I've been married to Megan about 10 years. Before I realised just what a committed commie she was. Not really. But, you know, she was pretty red. And I did not realise. So she organised a nationwide industrial action. And she was in the newspapers. And it was incredible. It took her 3 years and she conquered the company with her union laws. Wow, I was overwhelmed. It's like, my goodness, I had no idea the strength of this woman. But then there's these just general misunderstandings and miscommunications. As you know, just any two people, friends, let alone marriage partners, getting on in a fallen world, there's always going to be bumps, aren't there? So let me take you to a vignette, a little story. This is probably the most story part of the whole song. And because you know, this is how poetry is meant to work. You're meant to kind of just enjoy it. This is the part of the talk tonight where we're just going to read. I'll make a few comments as we go and just kind of try and lap it up. So this is from 5:2 to 6:3. And I think it's a vignette which shows classic kind of misunderstandings, miscommunications, and that kind of thing. So 5 verse 2 says, again, this is mostly her voice. She says, "I slept, but my heart was awake." So that's a bit weird, isn't it? Is this going to be a dream sequence here? She's asleep, but her heart was awake? It is going to be bizarre, okay? I'll just warn you now. This is a bizarre little vignette. So maybe it is a dream, because dreams are pretty bizarre. Okay, "I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my beloved is knocking. He's saying, 'Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. My head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of night.'" You got the picture? Knock, knock. "I'm here. It's time for making love." 3. She says, "I've taken off my robe. Must I put it on again? I've washed my feet. Must I soil them again?" Is she angry with him for being so late? Or is she just genuinely too tired? Or is she teasing him? Egging him on, sort of. "Catch me if you can." We don't know. Verse 4, "My beloved thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. I rose to open for my beloved, my hands dripping with myrrh, my fingers with flowing myrrh on the handles of the bolt. I opened for my beloved." See, she's changed her mind. She wants him. "But my beloved had left." He was gone. "My heart sank at his departure. I looked for him but did not find him. I called for him but he did not answer." Again, we don't know why, do we? Has he gone off in a huff? Or did he not hear her when she did get up to open? We don't know. But we do know that she desperately wants to get to find him. And in fact, she goes through a lot, at least in the dream, to get him back. Verse 7, "The watchmen found me as they made their rounds in the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my cloak, those watchmen of the walls. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you, if you find my beloved, what will you tell him? Tell him I am faint with love." And now suddenly, in the dark, deserted streets of midnight Jerusalem, who should appear but her friends? They're in the street too. How about that? What a cool dream. Her friends say, "How is your beloved better than others, most beautiful of women? How is your beloved better than others that you so charge us?" And here you get this beautiful answer from her, this kind of description of her man. We've had several descriptions from him, haven't we, about her. Here's the one in the song where she describes him. What do you think she's describing here? Verse 10. "My beloved is radiant and ruddy. He's outstanding among 10,000. His head is purest gold. His hair is wavy and black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by the water streams, washed in milk, mounted like jewels. His cheeks are like beds of spices yielding perfume. His lips are like lilies dripping with myrrh." Notice again, same. She spends so much time on his head, but she now goes down. "His arms are rods of gold set with topaz. His body is like polished ivory decorated with lapis lazuli. His legs are pillars of gold set on bases of pure gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as its cedars." This is not really an identity kit, is it? This is not, you know, he's 6'4" and... What's she describing? His character, right? His character. He's strong. He's dignified. He's reliable. And I think she's describing his character in those kind of terms, because now, having gone down, she goes back up to where? The mouth. Not the organ that you eat with. She's describing the organ that he speaks with. His mouth is sweetness itself. This is wisdom literature, right? He speaks wise words. He is altogether lovely. This is my beloved. This is my friend, daughters of Jerusalem. And that little phrase there, I think, this is my beloved, this is my friend, is kind of her equivalent of last week's when he said, my bride, my sister. My beloved, my friend. Well, now it gets really weird. It's been weird enough as a dream, but now it gets really weird. So they say, okay, where has your beloved God, most beautiful of women? Which way did your beloved turn that we may look for him with you? And here's the answer, 6 verse 2. My beloved has gone down to his garden. What's that from last week? My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the bed of spices, to browse in the gardens, and to gather lilies. I am my beloved, and my beloved is mine. He browses among the lilies. What's her answer to her friends? Please look for my husband. I'm faint with love for him. Where's he gone? Actually, he's gone nowhere. He's right here in my embrace, in my arm. He's enjoying his garden, my body that I've given him. As I said, it's kind of the most narrative of the vignettes in the whole song. And it's this kind of strange parallel universe going on, isn't there? That they're kind of there together, but they're missing each other. They're kind of committed to each other, but they've got this misunderstanding going on. It's like they're racing after each other. Well, but they're still together. And I think this is a fantastic kind of window into just how so many miscommunications can happen in any good relationship, as I said, but in a deep, intimate one as well, like a marriage relationship. It started out, it seems, like a sexual misunderstanding. But I think it probably could be broadened out as well. Sex in marriage can be quite difficult. There's a lot of fun, but there's a lot of getting used to each other as well. There's a lot of misunderstandings at times. The classic times when sex is difficult is right at the start of the marriage. Just kind of, you feel awkward, you feel embarrassed, you feel like you don't know what you're doing, all of that kind of stuff. Around childbearing years, very, very difficult for some people. And then, of course, the other classic time in old age, when sexual function is withering away. But the picture here, I think, can be broadened out to just general difficulties in a relationship of marriage. We live in a fallen world, as I said. There's always the prospect of death. There's always family dysfunction. You don't need me to tell you this. Some of you have experienced this quite profoundly personally, haven't you? That you know that, well, a good marriage is not one that has no problems. Because a good marriage is rather a marriage that has the strength of a myriad of problems all faced and resolved as best as is possible in this life. But as best as is possible in this life still leaves lots of gap. And so, though it's not a happily ever after kind of story, kind of song, the Song of Songs does press into us that it's worth preserving and working together in a marriage relationship. That is a one flesh union for life. And so even though there are difficulties, misunderstandings, it's worth preserving. And I'm going to explore two of them with you that the Song of the Song, I think, in these last chapters, kind of presents to us. And the first kind of set of reasons is because the Song of Songs, the assumption, the view is that sex and marriage go together. Okay, there's one not before the other or outside of the other, they go together. So the first set of reasons are actually about, you know, faithful, mature sex together helps you persevere together in marriage. Actually, the little passage that Donna read for us in chapter 7, I think, presents one of these reasons. We'll come to a second reason soon, but she starts out in verse 10 of 7, I belong to my beloved, his desire is for me. This is now the fourth time she's said something like this. This is a mutually exclusive relationship. I am his, he is mine, we like each other, we enjoy each other. So what does she say? Verse 11. Come, my beloved, let us go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. Let's go early to the vineyards to see if the vines have budded, if their blossoms have opened, and if the pomegranates are in bloom. There I will give you my love. The mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both new and old, that I have stored up for you, my beloved. She's wanting a weekend to the Hunter Valley, isn't she? Or she, you know, she wants to go to the Barossa with him. Like, let's have a country escape and make love and let's have a romantic weekend away together. That's what she's asking. Now, of course, she wants more than romance. She wants companionship and friendship, which is why she goes on in 8 verse 1, which I looked at before. But she definitely is looking forward to maintaining their relationship romantically and sexually. And verse 13 is just a bolter, I reckon. It's just a fantastic reason to preserve and keep sex in marriage. She says, at our door is every delicacy. Isn't that just a beautiful phrase? We, you see, have a kaleidoscope. Every delicacy imaginable just for us. We have this long history together which has provided a myriad of memories together and experiences and growth in our capacities of pleasing each other. And that means that the delicacies are new and old. That's the key phrase there, I think. So in a marriage relationship that's preserved for many years, where you've worked at your relationship, including your sex life, you have both new and old delicacies to enjoy that you've stored up for each other, you see. There's something really, really thrilling about having old delicacies in the bedroom. You know, your old favourites. I'm speaking as a married man of 24 and a half years. Megan and I worked for a relationships organisation called Interrelate for about 10 years. And we used to run 2 to 3 marriage enrichment weekends a year. And the universal kind of witness from kind of faithful, passionate, older married couples is the best years are just getting better. Their sex life in their third decade was far better than their sex life in their second decade, and that was better than the first. You know what I mean? It's just old delicacies. But that gives you the base, doesn't it, for new delicacies as well. There's something really, really dreary about novelty all the time. Which, of course, is what shacking up is about. It's, you know, there's kind of the thrill and the excitement, but if everything's always new all the time, you don't have any sense of, you know, being comfortable, always a little bit sort of awkward. There's another reason given, and that's in chapter 8, verse 10. This is belongs to a longer context, but I think I'll just go to the one verse, 8 verse 10. This is her voice again. I am a wall, and my breasts are like towers. Thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment. Again, same image here. I am a wall. I have defined relationship. I'm protected. I know who belongs to me and who I belong to. And there's no crossing of those barriers. I'm a wall. But within that wall, my breasts are like towers. They're for his enjoyment. And thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment or peace or shalom. When sex is not commodified into a kind of mere exchange of pleasure, but as an expression of complete commitment, whole person for the whole life, that is just a safety zone. That is just peace right there. There's kind of no second guessing about, you know, the other person's intentions. Is this just sex, or is this, what is this? There's no anxious comparisons going on internally, worrying about, oh gee, how do I measure up? Anything like that. Thus I have become in his eyes like one bringing contentment, peace, shalom, wholeness. So it's worth persevering and working together in marriage. But not just sexually, actually. The kind of the final. I've lost the literary word. The final kind of climax, maybe. Yeah, the final climax of the song is actually just before this. It's 8:5-7, and I say that it's the climax because this is where her speaking kind of her voice goes into this general kind of conclusion. Who is this coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? This is 8 verse 5. Who is this coming up from the wilderness? Do you remember last week that question was asked? Who is this coming up from the wilderness? And who was it? Well, it was the foil of Solomon. But no, it was actually not that wedding. It was her coming across the wilderness to be married. But here, who is this coming up from the wilderness? She's leaning on her beloved. They're married. And she says, under the apple tree I roused you. Apparently in 2 verse 3, this is where she first kind of convinced him to pursue her. There it was also apparently where your mother conceived you, who in labor gave you birth. And she says to him, place me like a seal over your heart and like a seal on your arm. We're not sure that the ancient Hebrews had any sort of seal, like we have a wedding band. But that's what she's saying. She said, place me like a seal over your heart, internally, and on your arm, visibly, externally, to the wider world. Why? Why have that kind of relationship? Committed, self-giving, exclusive. Here's the reason. For love is as strong as death. It's jealousy, unyielding as the grave. It burns like a blazing fire, like an almighty flame. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot sweep it away. If one were to give all the wealth of one's house for love, it would be utterly scorned. This kind of love is worth more than trillions and billions of dollars. It's as strong as death, in fact. death has its tentacles on all of us, doesn't it? Even now. It's dragging us to the grave. It's so powerful. Everything dies in our worlds. It's so strong, death. And death ruptures relationships, friendships, and marriages. Perhaps if love wasn't as strong as death, no one would be tempted to be married, would they? Because it's just heartache at the end. As your spouse of 40 years dies, or 5 years gets cancer. But love is as strong as death, he says. When I was a uni student, another girl in Credo. Sorry. It was called CF then. Okay, so Credo is 38 years old, but for the first 23, it was called CF, Christian Fellowship. She had become a Christian at uni. And she had AIDS. She had AIDS from high school encounters with bisexual partners, etc. She'd become a Christian and had fallen in love with a guy, another Christian guy. Now, this was going to be a Christian relationship. And when she told him that she was only going to be living for a few years, I love you. Love is as strong as death. They went ahead and they got married, and it wasn't even 2 years, actually. This is the kind of love that this song is celebrating. Powerful, burning, jealous. The ultimate consummation of love, I think this is saying, is not sex. That's really important. That does consummate your relationship for sure. But the ultimate consummation of love, with this undying, intimate, self-giving relationship that's mutually exclusive, such as this couple depicted here, that couple I just told you about. It's seen in the companionship and the self-giving to each other. And you probably see it, and you might even know about it. Those married couples who are just incapacitated sexually because of health or medical reasons or whatever. And yet they couldn't have a closer bond still. I think this kind of love is actually another rumour of God in our world. Because nothing else can explain this kind of powerful force, I don't think. Nothing, in fact, else can explain our being enraptured with beauty either. And I think this is what verse 6 is saying here, in 8 verse 6. Love burns like blazing fire, like an almighty flame. That's a kind of reference to God there. It's a God flame. This kind of love participates in the kind of the very characteristic of God. Sacrificial love, life-giving love, committed love, desirous love. What other explanation is there? You see, if it is true, as the kind of the materialists, the secularists say, that really what we are is just kind of a machine that's loaded up with some software called DNA. And that's all it is. When you feel love, when you commit yourself to someone in love like this, all it really is the chemicals going, woo. That just destroys love in the end, doesn't it? That's like, oh, really? I thought I was a person who chose to give my life to this person in love, sacrificially. But no, really all I am is kind of this robot being poked by some bland chemicals. Maybe I don't really love this person after all. If brain chemistry and our DNA, it's just not enough to explain this kind of love, let alone maintain it. I think this is a rumour of God to our world. Now, I've got a conclusion. It's a very strange conclusion. As normal, it's going to link to Jesus and show how actually the book kind of points to him in a way. But I just want to pause now and ask, is there any questions? Is something I've said kind of confusing? Do you want more, I don't know, more argument from me, more support, something? Do you want me to dance? Yeah.
Will there be marriage in the new creation?
I'll come back to that in the conclusion. That is the conclusion, actually. Yeah. You are too smart, James. Others? Did what I say make sense? I've turned this amazing song and poetry into kind of a fairly didactic analyst, so I'm sorry for that. Just go and read it and go, yes. A marriage will have problems, but it's worth maintaining. Okay. None? Yes.
Well, there's, you know, a lot of stuff in the press about the future of marriage, you know, redefining marriage, same-sex marriage, all that kind of
thing. Yeah.
Do you want to comment on that stuff from this, or is that just...
I made some comments in the first talk, although more pastoral comments.
Yeah, true.
So maybe listen to the podcast on that. I think a key question that our society is not asking is, what is the purpose of marriage? They're asking, what is marriage? But I think that's kind of the wrong question. I think we need to be asking, what is the purpose of marriage? Because if you work out the purpose of something, that will give you the answer to the other one. And then, of course, our public laws are... don't define those things, but kind of are meant to support them. So I know that's incredibly conceptual, a very conceptual answer. But I think all this argument about the definition of marriage and all that, well, what we really need to work out is what the purpose of it is. And the purpose in the Song of Songs, which is a celebration song, and what you celebrate you affirm, and what you affirm you value, is... this lifelong, consummated, complementary relationship of a man and a woman. There is very little, in this song at least, about progeny, like offspring. Although I think it is definitely there in the background. So the fact that she keeps saying, look, I need you to meet my mother and all that kind of stuff, even there in... 8 verse 2, I would lead you and bring you to my mother's house. She taught me. There's a concept of, the reason why that's important is because their relationship is actually a blessing because they've been given life from a previous relationship. I'm tempted to just waffle for hours on that, so sorry, I might just stop there. It's worth thinking about.
Yes, how would you respond to, I guess, one of the current arguments that says, well, look, Christians, you can have your views on marriage, you can still continue with that definition, but the rest of society, if they're not Christians, why should they be bound to that? How would you respond to that, I guess, without watering it down, but also not sort of, I guess, giving too much ground?
Wow. Okay, so one thing I would say is that most Christians, I would argue, most Christians have always seen marriage not as a faith or religious or Christian thing, particularly, but a society thing. Does that make sense? I know there are some sort of traditions in Christianity where it is very much, it's like a sacrament or whatever, but I think most Christians have always argued, no, this is a social thing. I would definitely protest against the view that says you get your views on marriage from your Christianity, therefore you can't have a voice. I think that's just silly argumentation. In fact, I would almost go as far as say, no, 30% of marriages are still performed by Christian ministers, so therefore we actually should have an extra voice, really, to just recognise reality. Yeah, so there's some things I'm thinking off the top of my head. Yeah. I think I've missed something, some big thing. Restate your question again, because I had something else in my head.
It's basically, they'd say, well, look, Christians, you have your views on marriage and you can practice
yes.
how you see fit, but we're not Christians, don't impose your views.
I think there is a measure of truth in that, in the sense that, even though, despite what I said before about actually Christians have always viewed marriage as not a particularly Christian thing, but a general thing, and even society still recognises that by the fact that 30% of marriages happen inside a church, etc., and certainly not 30% of society goes to church. I think there is a measure of truth in that, in the sense that unless you have the faulty view that Christian morality is should be mirrored in secular laws, then I think you have to allow for some potential gaps, and be happy with that. So Christians have happily lived for thousands of years in society where polygamy was practiced, you know, but they didn't, because that's not, you know, the Christian. And yeah, so Christians are actually incredibly good citizens of any country in the world, because they're kind of happy to kind of give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and to God what belongs to God, in that sense. So
I think I'd say, like, if we don't want to be imposing beliefs on people who aren't Christians, holding them to what the Bible says of real marriage is, but we believe that marriage has been ordained by God, and what has been ordained by God is genuinely what is in the best interests of people and all humanity. So I think in that sense it's important that we have a voice to defend, just out of love for the rest of society.
I think definitely voting a particular way because you're a Christian and having an opinion is not forcing your views on anyone.
Yeah.
It's just participating in the discourse of the public society. Yeah, and you do it gently and sensitively and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I've got one.
Yes.
Maybe a fairly sensitive question for some people, but I suppose, like, we talk about all this passion that you're saying, like, the fact that it comes, that we have it and we can explain it, you know, a man for a woman comes from God, but, like, how do we explain the possibly equal passion that,
yeah.
you know, same-sex attraction would
yeah.
Have a peak, like, people would have one man may have for another man and
yeah.
vice versa, like, how do you think a Christian can like, sort of psychologically explain it if we talk about, you know, this heterosexual attraction is...
Yeah. Yeah, very hard. At one level, it's really... I know the kind of the... what's the song? The Same Love? Is that how it goes? The Same Love? I know that's the song, the rap song. It's The Same Love. But I just wonder how empirically that would be testable. I'm not arguing that it's, you know, same-sex attraction is not real and not powerful and all that kind of stuff, but I feel like almost by definition it is, it might look similar or, but it's almost by its nature quite different, isn't it? Because a marriage between a man and a woman is an inclusive relationship. It includes both genders. That's an incredible strength, isn't it? Actually, in the most intimate, lifelong relationship, it's inclusive. of both genders. It recognizes that both genders are important. Whereas a same-sex relationship excludes, actually, the other agenda. So, yeah, I wouldn't want to sort of say, oh, look, your feelings, you know, they're not real or whatever. Or anything like that. I just don't know whether they are... Maybe this is not your question, Tristan, but I just don't know whether the government can't legislate for feelings. That's what I feel. Like, how on earth can the law do that?
I totally understand what you're saying. Yeah. I don't know if it completely answers my question.
Yeah,
okay. It's very complex, though.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I wouldn't know the first way to answer it myself. But I was just curious as to...
That's more the line that I tried to go down in the first talk, where I said, look, I've been in Credo for over 20 years, not 38, and there's very few years where I've not known people in Credo who've been same-sex attracted. They're genuinely converted, they love Jesus, they do find it hard in our midst, but they want to stay faithful. They buy the celebration of the song, if you like, that, you know, that they recognise that that's how marriage ought to be, and so they come to some very hard decisions about, okay, well, how am I going to live my life? Am I going to please don't take this the wrong way, it's an allusion to what Jesus said, have I been born a eunuch? Do I need to stay single? So that's a phrase from Jesus in Matthew 19, verse 10 or something. He says, for those who can accept this, I recognising that it's a hard teaching, but some are born eunuchs, some are made eunuchs by others, and some decide to be eunuchs for the kingdom. I think that's the Christian option for those who have... same-sex attraction. And I'm not speaking as someone who doesn't have very close connection with people whom I love and cherish. Final question? Do we have time? Yes, we have time for one more. Okay, let's go to the conclusion then. James, you're way ahead, mate. This book, this song, this epic love poem, it finishes very enigmatically, okay? It's just weird, and it's just kind of like, almost like, oh, really? So go to the last two stanzas, 8, 13 and 14. His voice, you who dwell in the gardens with friends in attendance, you know how she's always talking to her friends, so he's talking to his bride. You who dwell in the gardens with friends and attendants, let me hear your voice. See, he's still got this kind of desire to have more of her. Her voice, her mouth is the most beautiful thing. What she says, just, he hasn't got enough yet. He wants more. He wants to go deeper. And she says, come away, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the spice-laden mountains. Again, she's saying, yes, let's recapture our love. Let's stoke it up. It's flagged. And that's it. That's how it ends. With this kind of sense of... What? You just have to keep renewing your love? Because it flags? But yes, that's how it ends. That's how it ends. And it's kind of almost reaching out, you see, for a deeper consummation than even the celebration that's been given here. And it's a really weird passage, but I believe that's what Jesus talks about when he talks about there not being marriage in the New Age. So this question comes up in Luke chapter 20. like, marriage is a good thing. They all know that, at least the people who are conversing with Jesus. Marriage is a really good thing. And so in the age to come, in the age of the resurrection, like if you've, you know, if you've had a wife and then she died and you had it married again, like, which wife, you know, will he belong to? That kind of stuff. Or, so how can this really good thing be accounted for in the age to come? And Jesus says, those who belong to this age, this is, sorry, Luke 20, verse 34. Jesus said to them, those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage. But those who are considered worthy of a place in that age and in the resurrection from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. Indeed, they cannot die anymore because they are like angels and are children of God, being children of the resurrection. He's pointing to a time when even the best of marriages, that's the Song of Songs, will be pulled up into something even grander. And I know that this hits our kind of grid and bounces off. No, surely this is there's nothing better in life than this, what we've been looking at the last 3 weeks. But Jesus said, absolutely. In the age to come, there will be even more profound weight of glory, of relating, of knowing. And of course, what this does is it, as good as this is, it kind of, for Christians, it kind of relativizes it actually, and goes, okay, if marriage comes my way, it's a gift from God, I'll receive it, I'll, you know, enjoy it, I'll work hard at it. But if it doesn't, that's okay too, because, well, there's not going to be marriage in the age to come. So you see, marriage for a Christian reflects one particular aspect of God and eternal life, which is his utter commitment to us in Christ, dying for us to redeem us and to be kind of wedded to us. But serving God singly as well reflects the future age in the sense that there will be no real marriage between humans there, because we'll all be utterly devoted and besotted with God himself and living in his world. And so what I want to say to conclude is, you know how I said, you know, we've all experienced, probably even if we've grown up in a stable home, the fact that there's been difficulties, the fact that there's been problems, the things that have kind of stayed with us and impacted us. And have hope in Jesus for this new age, where even those things, you see, the result of marriages in this life that have impacted us will be kind of transformed. I hope you can look forward to that day. You definitely can if you're trusting in Jesus and his death and resurrection. Let's pray. Someone's going to pray with me. We'll try not to dance as we pray. Who is it? James. James, you better tell us a bit about yourself. Given that you're so smart and ask the questions.
Hello, I'm James. I am a second year business and IT.